Chapter 21. The Polarization. 6 of the 11 top-rated TV shows in 1969 were Bob Hope specials. But Bob's annual Christmas special from Vietnam took on a harder edge this year. During their round at Burning Tree Country Club, the president had lined up the comedian as a soldier for positive polarization, and just before the new Moab protest, Hope sent out a letter to every senator. How about a big cheer for the great USA? A committee has been formed to salute a work of national unity, and I am proud to serve as their national chairman. There are millions of Americans of all ages who make up the silent majority, and we are urging them to participate in activities from coast to coast to display unity in America. I certainly hope you will accept my invitation to serve as a co-chairman. Please wire your confirmation to me at Hollywood, California, so that we may unite in this program together. Warmest regards, Bob, for a week of national unity, Hope. Unity was in the eye of the beholder. Bob's specials had always flown the standard of patriotic reassurance. Bob wasn't born, he was woven by Betsy Ross, a friend told Time in a 1967 cover feature. Now the hunger for reassurance was desperate. That was what gave Hope, who started his tour for the first time with a command performance at the White House, his new right-wing edge. Bantering with Romy Schneider, the German ingenue who co-starred in Woody Allen's What's New, Pussycat, Hope called Allen the little spider monkey with a falsetto voice. He called Laugh-In fruitcake galore. He dipped into drug humor to reach his live audience. GIs in Vietnam high on Hope's marijuana jokes, the New York Times reported from Vietnam December 23rd. But none of those jokes made it into the broadcast when it ran in January. That would have soured the story they were telling, that the old, good, pure Betsy Ross America that only talked about sex with a wink and nudge was still going as strong as ever. But jingoism was a difficult sell these days. At 1st Division headquarters, the camera panned over the crowd, the traditional mocking banners, "Welcome Bing Crosby." But many weren't wearing shirts. Most had shaggy hair. Some wore mustaches and necklaces with garish medallions. Tom Sawyer faced Neil Armstrong, the first man to step on the moon, an icon of the new square chic. He brought his fraternity pin along on Apollo 11, did a question and answer session. The NBC cameras trained upon a blonde nurse in hippie sunglasses, asking him in all earnestness when you're going to take the first woman to the moon. Armstrong answered with leering innuendo. Bob chimed in with a joke about diet-conscious ladies. I'm sure they'll all go when they find they can go up there and be weightless. Meanwhile, the camera found a banner out in the crowd, a peace symbol, and the circle and cross emblem of women's liberation. The show ended, as always, with a sentimental Bob Hope exhortation. This year it folded in clumsy damage control from My Lai. The numbers of them who devote their free time, energies, and money to aiding Vietnamese families and caring for orphans would surprise you. Or maybe it wouldn't. I guess you know what kind of guys your brothers and the kids next door are. They need our full support. They deserve our backing to a man and our prayers. It's the least you can do. Good night. Betsy Ross was taking on a partisan edge, too. 18 million Reader's Digest subscribers received detachable flag decals inside the special February 1969 America in Transition issue. 31 million more wrote in to request one. The left-wing folk singer John Prine responded, in song, upon digesting Reader's Digest in the back of a dirty bookstore, that waving flags didn't get you into heaven anymore. They're already too crowded from your dirty little war. 5 years after Lyndon Johnson was elected on a platform of consensus, every conceivable cultural expression fell to one or another side of the American ideological divide. Smart businessmen figured out ways to sell to both sides. The Christmas season's most brilliant entrepreneur was surely the guy who invented the Spiro Agnew wristwatch. Hipsters bought it as a kitschy screw you to his admirers. The silent majority bought it as a screw you to his detractors. Soon, TV producer Norman Lear would have a new hit show, All in the Family. The sympathetic character was supposedly the long-haired liberal son-in-law. The racist, know-nothing father was the butt of the jokes. Lear never dreamed what would happen next. Archie Bunker was embraced as a hero by the very people the show was meant to lampoon. To be taken seriously as a voice of cultural authority, you had to somehow straddle the cultural canyon. The nation's flagship Panglossian weekly, Time, had chosen as its 1966 Man of the Year not just a new generation, but a new kind of generation. In 1969, they excused that generation's LSD-taking as a near-religious sacrament. The editors had placed a Time sort of bet that they could frictionlessly ease new sensibilities into the mainstream, the better to shore up consensus. This year, they made a different bet by naming, as Men and Women of the Year, the Middle Americans, a state of mind, a morality, a construct of values and prejudices and a complex of fears. Middle Americans were those whom pornography, dissent, and drugs seemed to wash over, in waves bearing some of their children away. They loved the moonshot, a victory purely accomplished. This, they will say with an air of embarrassment that such a truth needed to be stated at all, is the greatest country in the world. Why are people trying to tear it down? And though Time couldn't bring itself to admire all their enthusiasms, Middle Americans liked Spiro Agnew, the editors claimed, only to some extent, it celebrated Richard Nixon for reflecting, like many Middle Americans, a contradictory mixture of liberal and conservative impulses. He was pursuing not so much a Southern strategy as a Middle American strategy. His draft reforms, instituting selection by lottery, brought a new equity to the selective service system. He'd ended U.S. production of biological weapons, begun the strategic arms limitation talks, SALT, with the Soviet Union. He was allowing some southern school districts more time to formulate their desegregation plans, but chose as his Chief Justice Warren Burger, whose Supreme Court unanimously rejected the delays. Perfect equipoise. Some of the Middle Americans Time profiled were bitter. Richard W. Paul, 43, a white-collar worker at GE in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, said, "I'm angry because I keep getting kicked around. I'm getting squeezed by the urban coalition, these bankers, everybody who thinks they are doing these poor people a favor by moving them into somebody else's backyard, as long as it isn't their backyard." But the package ended with a feature on 9 former high school football stars in a small Arizona town who joined the Marines together on Independence Day, 1966. Only 3 of Morenci's 9 Marines made it back alive, yet none of the 3 is really angry about the war. Perfect equipoise, a perfect fantasy. A more realistic American tableau was unfolding in Chicago, where the conspiracy trial was at its entropic height. During jury selection, the questions the defense wanted the pool to be asked included, "Do you know who Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix are?" And, "If your children are female, do they wear brassieres all the time?" In a pretrial hearing, Judge Hoffman described the intent standard by which the defendants were to be judged. The substance of the crime was a state of mind. That was just the way Time had defined Middle America, a state of mind. To that standard, the defense was glad to accede. When the 12 jurors turned out to be middle-class and middle-aged, except for 2 girls in their early 20s, Leonard Weinglass, the lead defense attorney, moved for a mistrial, claiming his clients weren't being judged by a jury of their peers, which would have to be chosen also from people not drawn from the voter rolls because blacks, the young, dropouts, and misfits were not well enough represented on them. The government had selectively indicted to display a cross-section of the monstrous personages rending the good order of American civilization. The older guru, David Dellinger, 2 long-haired freaks, Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, the by-any-means-necessary Negro, Bobby Seale, 2 SDS militants, Tom Hayden, Rennie Davis, 2 radical young faculty members, a chemistry professor, John Freunds, and a sociology professor, Lee Weiner, who were supposed to have planned a bombing. The prosecutors warned on TV that the defendants might walk into court the first day naked. That didn't happen, though when court adjourned on New Year's Eve, defendant Freunds and his girlfriend did pass out autographed nude posters of themselves. The jury was sequestered every minute they were outside the federal building. If states of minds were on trial, even the cultural air was prejudicial. Some stories they missed. The mobilization, the silent majority speech, the moratorium, the rise of Spiro Agnew, the second moonshot, the My Lai massacre. They received a respite from cabin fever the day after Christmas when they were treated to a Disney on Parade show. But even that was prejudicial. The monkeys in the Jungle Book number were go-go girls. Alice in Wonderland was done up in psychedelic patterns. Jerry Rubin called his indictment the Academy Award for Protest. Judge Julius Hoffman seemed to relish the notion. "Tell me something," he asked New York Times reporter Tony Lucas, who had called up to ask for press credentials. "Do you think this is going to be the trial of the century?" Outside, trial marshals confiscated spoons, books, compacts, nail clippers, attaché cases, and two pistols. Defense sympathizers waited half the night in line for a spot in the gallery. The judge gave seats instead to Chicago socialites. One hippie who survived the gauntlet leapt up in the spectators' gallery during a defense argument to cry, "Right on," and was swarmed so badly, a witness thought marshals might have broken some bones. When Bobby Seale's family managed to get seats, Judge Julius Hoffman summoned a marshal and had these strange people with bushy afros removed. The jury wouldn't be able to watch his child's and wife's reactions when Seale was bound and gagged like a slave. They weren't there on November 5, 1969, either, when Judge Hoffman sentenced Seale to an unprecedented 4 years in prison for 16 counts of contempt of court and severed his case from the rest, turning the Chicago 8 into the Chicago 7. Reporters made a mad dash for the phones. The courtroom marshals unpinned their badges, put them in their pockets, and scoured the jammed courtroom for anything else sharp, fearing an outbreak of hand-to-hand combat. The next day, a defense lawyer argued the 4-year sentence was illegal and asked the judge to explain himself. Judge Hoffman replied, "I have known literally thousands of what we used to call Negro people, and who are now referred to as black people, and I have never heard that kind of language emanate from the lips of any of them." That was the day Bob Hope sent out his letter to senators for a week of national unity. Judge Julius J. Hoffman was a strutting little bantam cock of a man. On the first day of jury selection, he read out the indictment to the jury pool like a 19th-century thespian. Defense lawyer William Kunstler objected. Judge Hoffman boomed, "Motion denied," and said he'd never apologize for the vocal facilities the Lord hath given me. When one of his young law clerks was told to prepare a denial of the defendant's motion to see their wiretap logs, and replied, "But Judge, that's not fair," citing the plain letter of the law, the old man flew into a rage that awed his clerk, who was told not to return to work after his vacation. Federal judge selection was supposed to be random, but in Chicago, the fix was always in. In big mob cases, the state always angled to argue before Judge Hoffman. He always decided against the defendant and made the prosecuting attorneys look like heroes. He is the bane of do-gooders who would give every bum a second chance, and a third, and a fourth, and a fifth, Chicago's American said. He was also a self-hating Jew who took willful pleasure in mispronouncing his fellow Jews' names. Wineglass, Wineglass, Weintraub, Weinruss, Weinrob, and wouldn't let one witness wear a yarmulke in court. "Take off your hat, sir." He popped a vein when Abby Hoffman called himself his illegitimate son, but hated David Dellinger, Derringer, Dillinger, most of all. He was a wasp who'd surrendered privileges the judge so dearly wished to possess. Hoffman was especially taken aback when one of the defendants informed him that the plaque for the Northwestern Law School classroom named after him had been ripped from the wall. "The plaque?" Apparently, while the Board of Trustees feels affection for you, the student body does not. The defense was determined to put the war on trial, and the defendant's lifestyle on proud display. The Boston Five had sat like good little boys called into the principal's office, Dr. Spock had pointed out, and were railroaded nonetheless. The Chicago defendants were determined to show why their state of mind was morally superior. The 74-year-old they called Mr. Magoo was a hanging judge, hired to grease the rails for a conviction that would only be overturned on appeal. It was a show trial, so why not put on a show? The prosecution presented its case first. Their witnesses were undercover infiltrators. Once, when a witness was called just as one of the defendants exited a side door, the rest of the Chicago 7 braced themselves. Was one of their own a police spy? Actually, he was just going to the bathroom. One prosecution witness was simultaneously a member of the Executive Committee of Veterans for Peace, the Chicago Peace Council, the New Mobilization Committee to End the War, and the Chicago Police Department Red Squad. The people most useful in the movement, radicals often learned too late, were the ones later revealed to be spies. Being paid for their time by the government, they were the most avid volunteers. Another had enrolled in the Northeastern Illinois State College SDS and had led a group that pushed Northeastern's president off a speaker's platform. The most militant activists, radicals also discovered too late, were often police agent provocateurs. He testified that Rennie Davis said their plan to recruit for Chicago was to lure them here with music and sex. At the meeting where he claimed he heard that, he himself had suggested disabling army jeeps with grappling hooks. A third prosecution witness was a college newspaper reporter hired as a spy by the Chicago's American columnist Jack Mabley. A fourth had worked as Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin's dirtbag motorcycle gang bodyguard. A fifth was a policewoman who dressed for her work at Lincoln Park every day in white hippie bell-bottoms carrying a .38 Colt in her bag. This witness, Officer Barbara Callender, testified blushingly, "Every other word was that F-word." Cross-examination. "Haven't you ever heard that word in the station house?" The government objected to the line of questioning. The objection was sustained. Part of the prosecution's strategy was to establish that the defendants were obscene. 10 days later, when another Red Squad member testified, he said he'd told a newsman to turn the censored cameras around because of that civilian brutality. His side believed it was obscenity to say, "censored," without blushing. The other believed it was obscenity during an evil war to save your shame for mere words. The war was the obscenity. A joke going around the New Left. A policeman tells a protester to come back after she has removed the obscenity from her "fuck the war" placard, and she returns with one reading, "fuck the blank." The prosecutors, U.S. attorneys Richard Schultz and Thomas Aquinas Varan, were perfectly cast. Schultz was so ploddingly literal-minded, he could call the most obvious yippie put-ons devious incitements to riot. Varan was a Democrat who said he had been a closer friend of the late Bobby Kennedy's than Tom Hayden had been. In his summation, he spoke of his empathy for the kids who feel that the lights have gone out in Camelot. But these guys take advantage of them. They take advantage of it personally, intentionally, evilly, and to corrupt those kids, they use them. And they use them for their purposes and for their intents. And you know what are their purposes and intents? This is in their own words. To disrupt. To pin delegates in the convention hall. To clog streets. To force the use of troops. To have actions so militant the guard will have to be used. Tear this city apart. Fuck up this convention. We'll lure the McCarthy kids and other young people with music and sex and try to hold the park. The prosecution's aim was to reduce a complex stew of motives, interests, approaches, and personalities to a concentrated, unified plot. They said David Dellinger, the Gandhian who had little direct role in Chicago, was only pretending to be a pacifist and was really the rioting's chief architect. "Oh, bullshit, that is a complete lie," Dellinger shouted. "Did you get that, Miss Reporter?" Judge Hoffman replied and revoked Dellinger's bail. Prosecutors said the ham-handed self-defense training in Lincoln Park was combat training. Patrolman Frappoli described a meeting in which he claimed he heard plans to throw burning flares at the cops. Mr. Foran, "Were any of the defendants present?" The witness, "Yes, Weiner and Freunds were at this meeting. So was Abby Hoffman." Mr. Foran, "Do you see Mr. Hoffman here in the courtroom?" The witness, "Yes, I do." Mr. Foran, "Would you step down and point him out, please?" The witness, "Mr. Hoffman is sitting with a leather vest on, this shirt, he just shot me with his finger, his hair is very unkempt." The hippies' hippiness was on trial. Style was a battleground. Abby Hoffman, asked why they lured innocent youth to Chicago with sex and rock bands, replied, "Rock musicians are the real leaders of the revolution." Posture was a battleground. When Judge Hoffman admonished William Kunstler not to slouch on the lectern designed by the federal building's distinguished architect, Mies van der Rohe, Abby replied, "Mies van der Rohe was a kraut." He added that the courtroom was a neon oven, thus deploying his Madison Avenue brilliance in the service of the defendant's pet theory that America was becoming Nazi Germany. Pencils, even, became a battleground. Primely squared off and neatly sharpened beside a few neatly stacked memos on the prosecution table, the Evergreen Review's John Schultz wrote, askew and gnawed, and maybe encrusted with a sliver of earwax, a proud part of the unholy clutter on the defense table. When Abby Hoffman, a very hard worker, took the stand, he said, "Work is a dirty word," instead of "fuck is a dirty word." Humor was a battleground most of all. The judge fancied himself a rapier wit, but when the defense table laughed at him, or with the defense, as when Abby and Jerry showed up in judicial robes, he made sure the court reporter got it in the record, for in the courtroom, laughter wasn't appropriate. Which juryman laughed when was how both sides kept score. Based on that calculus, when the prosecution rested on December 9th, the day after the Nixon press conference that earned him a snap 81% approval rating, movement sympathizers predicted a hung jury. That prediction led to a debate in the defense camp. Tom Hayden said that since they weren't going to be convicted, they could best get on with the revolution if they rested their case without mounting a defense, ending the affair in a mistrial. Others, Abby, Jerry, said the trial was the revolution. The Yippies won. They would use their defense to introduce Woodstock Nation, the title of Abby's new book, to America. They would fight through the jungles of TV. They spoke at colleges, women's clubs, and churches to raise money for their defense, to warm receptions. At a Tony synagogue in suburban Highland Park, Illinois, 1,400 turned out to hear them. At universities, they were treated like the Beatles. At a University of Chicago rally, Rennie Davis announced he would continue fighting the way he was fighting, even if they put a pistol to his head. How can you be a young person and have any other position? Thomas Aquinas Ferran would have said the same thing if asked about his own position. It seemed an auspicious week to indict an establishment gone mad. As Wednesday night, December 3, 1969, became Thursday morning, December 4th, what the Chicago Tribune had called the wild gun battle at Black Panther headquarters in a West Side apartment building left two Panthers, 21-year-old leader Fred Hampton and Lieutenant Mark Clark, 22, dead. Louis Koch, the young New Left producer for the local NBC affiliate, smelled a rat and the cops claimed they were met with a shotgun volley. He'd seen film of the cops leaving the building, smiling, embracing, exulting as if they'd won a football game. Not the behavior of men who had just survived an ambush. He put Panther Bobby Rush on the afternoon news the next day, who called it cold-blooded murder, and invited viewers to the apartment to see for themselves. The Chicago Daily News columnist Mike Royko took him up on his offer. The morning that the conspiracy trial prosecution rested its case, Royko published a column called "The Hampton Bullet Holes." According to the police account, Royko wrote, miracles occurred. The Panthers' bullets must have dissolved in the air before they hit anybody or anything. Either that, or the Panthers were shooting in the wrong direction, namely, at themselves. Royko had examined the building with a ballistics expert, who identified at least 76 bullets coming in, including 24 on the wall near Hampton's bed, and not a single one coming out. Chicago cops failed to secure the crime scene. People lined up around the block to tour the open and shut evidence. Years later, it came out that the FBI COINTELPRO had provided Chicago cops with the floor plans of the apartment, and an FBI infiltrator had slipped secobarbital in Fred Hampton's drink the previous evening to make it easier to murder him in his bed. Such revelations would only have confirmed what the Chicago 7 defense already knew. The justice system wasn't a system of justice. Law and order was a cover for state-sponsored crime. Those same days, the last cop indicted for crimes during convention week was on trial. The jury absolved him of beating a 20-year-old hitchhiker after only an hour of deliberation. The prosecution was so convincing, the defense so obviously false, the shocked judge implored of the foreman, "Are you certain? Not guilty." The silent majority was practicing jury nullification, just as the Chicago 7 opened their defense. The first defense witness was a supervisor at a candy factory. He displayed slides he had taken of police chopping their way through a crowd, kicking kids when they were down, without provocation, he said. The next day, he was fired from his job, and any pretense to a straight defense was abandoned. The prosecution said the Chicago 7 had lured lambs to slaughter with music and sex. So the Chicago 7's defense would be music and sex. Jacques Levy, director of O Calcutta, the off-Broadway play where the cast took off their clothes, Timothy Leary, Allen Ginsberg, Country Joe McDonald were all called to the stand. Dr. Leary, what is your present occupation?
I am the Democratic candidate for governor in California.
Doctor, can you explain what a psychedelic drug is?
Judy Collins broke out into a chorus of, Where Have All the Flowers Gone?
Judge Hoffman, we don't allow singing in this court.
William Kunstler presented folkslinger Phil Oakes with exhibition D-147, the guitar he'd used to perform I Ain't Marching Anymore at the Festival of Life. He, too, tried and failed to sing.
The following colloquy ensued. Abby Hoffman had led the crowd in a chant of Fuck LBJ, didn't he?
Yes, I think he did.
Now, in your plans for Chicago, did you plan for public fornication in the park? Allen Ginsberg had been in Chicago helping calm things with his Buddhist chants. Judge Hoffman had once been an ally of Ginsberg's. He'd ruled in 1960 that the avant-garde Chicago literary magazine Big Table wasn't obscene, noting that William S. Burroughs's Naked Lunch was intended to shock the contemporary society in order perhaps to better point out its flaws and weaknesses, quoting the Ulysses decision on the subversive necessity of art. But that was a different age, when such nuances were possible. Now everyone had to choose a side. One day, a clerk at Barber's bookstore in Old Town saw a middle-aged man pacing around. A member of the prosecution team, he asked, Do you have any of Allen Ginsberg's books? She went to hunt some down. He said, Could you hurry it up? The future of the country may depend on this. Later that day, on the stand, Ginsberg explained, I was chanting a mantra called the Mala Mantra, the great mantra of preservation of that aspect of the Indian religion called Vishnu the Preserver. Thomas Aquinas Ferrand leafed through one of his newfound literary treasures. Mr. Ferrand. In The Empty Mirror, there is a poem called The Night Apple. The witness. Yes. Mr. Ferrand. Would you recite it for the jury? The witness. The night apple. Last night I dreamed of one I loved for 7 long years, but I saw no face, only the familiar presence of the body. Sweat, skin, eyes, feces, urine, sperm, saliva, all one odor and mortal taste. Ferrand, sarcastically. Could you explain to the jury what the religious significance of that poem is? Ginsberg, earnestly. If you could take a wet dream as a religious experience, I could. It is a description of a wet dream, sir. Defense witness Linda Hager Morse was a pretty Quaker girl from Philadelphia who had won the Kiwanis Decency Award and first marched for peace on New York's Fifth Avenue in 1965. She was now a revolutionary. The defense wanted her to talk about why it was necessary to overthrow capitalism. The judge ruled that out of order. The prosecution, however, was glad to pick up the thread in cross-examination, and the judge was glad to let them. What Morse said encapsulated the strangeness of the last 4 years of American history. One part sounded quite like Lyndon Johnson's Great Society speech. My ultimate goal is to create a society where everyone is fed, where everyone is educated, where everyone has a job, where everyone has a chance to express himself artistically or politically or spiritually or religiously. Johnson, a society of success without squalor, beauty without barrenness, works of genius without the wretchedness of poverty. The other part couldn't have been further afield from Johnson's consensus bromides. Assistant D.A. Schultz posed the question. You practice shooting an M1 yourself, don't you? The witness. Yes, I do. Mr. Schultz. You also practice karate, don't you? The witness. Yes, I do. Mr. Schultz. That is for the revolution, isn't it? The witness. After Chicago, I changed from being a pacifist to the realization that we had to defend ourselves. A non-violent revolution was impossible. I desperately wish it was possible. Rennie Davis thought this was the defense's most effective witness with the jury. He asked a reporter what he had thought of Morse's testimony. The reporter's answer spoke to the polarization. It certainly was a disaster for you. Now you've really had it. Could your daughter kill? The defendants had intended to win the sympathy of the big jury out there, the general public. Their message was seen through a glass darkly. What did go on in Justice Julius Hoffman's courtroom? Asked the back cover of one of the many paperback books that appeared later
reproducing court transcripts. With no cameras to record it, it was hard to know. Afterward, a friend asked Tony Lucas of the Times which of the defendants had defecated in the aisle of the courtroom. Most newspaper coverage came from second-hand wire reports, built from a written record that the judge made sure reflected every defense outrage and whitewashed every prosecution one. The Times' Lucas paid careful attention to such unfairness, but his editors pruned him ruthlessly. Abby Hoffman always shouted, Judge Hoffman always said, even if it was really the other way around. To much of the public, the presumption was that the defecation was non-stop. William Kunstler offered his summation to the jury on February 13, 1970. I think if this case does nothing else, perhaps it will bring into focus that again we are in a moment of history when a courtroom becomes the proving ground of whether we do live free or whether we do die free. Perhaps if you do what is right, perhaps Allen Ginsberg will never have to write again, as he did in Howl, I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness. Perhaps Judy Collins will never have to stand in any courtroom again and say, as she did, when will they ever learn? Thomas Foran offered his summation. At the beginning of this case, they were calling them all by diminutive names, Rennie and Abby and Jerry, trying to pretend they were young kids. But they are not kids. They are highly sophisticated, educated men, and they are evil men. The jury returned their verdict after 5 days. All seven were acquitted on the conspiracy count. Freunds and Weiner were acquitted of the charge they'd constructed an incendiary device. But Dellinger, Davis, Hayden, Hoffman, and Rubin were found guilty on the indictment's counts 2 through 6, which cited Title 18 United States Code Section 201, the provision of the Civil Rights Act of 1968, passed to honor the martyr Martin Luther King, outlawing the travel in interstate commerce with intent to incite, organize, promote, and encourage a riot, and to speak to assemblages of persons for the purposes of inciting, organizing, promoting, and encouraging a riot. The liberal editorialists praised the jury's ruling as judicious and well-considered, a complex split decision. The system worked. Spiro Agnew called it an American verdict. It was indeed an American verdict. Almost as soon as the trial began, the jury had split into polarized camps. One believed the defendants were not guilty on all accounts. The other believed they were guilty on all counts. Only 3 jurors actually agreed with the decision as rendered. They had socialized apart, eaten apart, and, when together, spent most of their time in the jury room debating child-rearing philosophy. One of the convict-on-all-accounts jurors talked about the time she took her willful daughter to see a shrink, who said she just needed love and patience, and how she stalked out, saying of her daughter that she needed to have something shoved down her throat. They voiced their fears that their children would end up hippies, said things like, they are evil, and this is like Nazi Germany, hippies want to take over the country, and they had no right to come into your living room. The liberal jurors argued that slovenliness wasn't a crime, the prosecution was corrupt, and that for the first time they were afraid the government might be spying on them. They wondered whether the anti-riot statute was constitutional. At that, the conservative side wondered, if the law didn't protect decent people from this, then what did it protect them from? A journalist later observed the sociology that divided the 2 groups. The convict-on-all-counts jurors tended to be people who had moved recently from the city of Chicago itself into the suburbs. They were the hard-line, we worked hard and won our way according to the standard rules of social mobility people. The acquittal jurors tended to be those who had been longer situated in the suburbs or outlying parts of the city, and were easier in their attitudes about raising children. Franklins and Orthogonians. They hated each other too much to agree on anything. They sent out notes to the judge that they were a hung jury. The judge refused to accept them. Keep deliberating. A juror finally brokered the split verdict compromise. Judge Hoffman still was not satisfied. So he exercised his discretionary power. Over 2 long days, he called each defendant and each defense lawyer before the bench and delivered contempt specifications for each act of schoolboy naughtiness, sometimes reading out long stretches from the record. Specification 1. On September 26th, during the opening statement by the government, Defendant Hoffman rose and blew a kiss to the jurors. Official transcript, page 9. Abby Hoffman got a day in jail for that. He got 6 days for calling the judge in Yiddish, Shanda Fur Di Goyim. The judge read the phrase, which meant a Jew who shames Jews in front of the Gentiles, from the transcript haltingly and pronounced, "I can't understand the following words." David Dellinger had insisted on moratorium day on reading a list of the war dead. For that, he got 6 months. The law had spoken. John Lindsay responded, "The blunt, hard fact is that we in this nation appear headed for a new period of repression, more dangerous than at any time in years." Ferran, at a booster club rally at a parochial high school, said, "We've lost our kids to the freaking fag revolution." Rennie Davis said that when he got out of jail, "I intend to move next door to Tom Ferran and bring his sons and daughters into the revolution, and turn the sons and daughters of the ruling class into Viet Cong." Jerry Rubin signed his new book, Do It, to Judge Hoffman, top yippie, who radicalized more young Americans than we ever could. And Tom Hayden said, "Our jury now is being heard from." In Ann Arbor, 5,000 students and hangers-on marched to City Hall, busting windows and wrecking cars. The FBI put a White Panther on the 10 most wanted list, who wrote from exile in the Michigan woods, "I don't want to make it sound like all you got to do is kill people, kill pigs, to bring about revolution. But it is up to us to educate the people to the fact that it is war, and a righteous revolutionary war." In Madison, a student stole an Air Force ROTC training plane and tried to bomb an Army ammunition plant, just as a student radical stole a plane in the newly released Zabriskie Point. The preliminaries in the trial of the Manson family were all over the news. Manson had hoped, it turned out, to form it a race war. Weatherman Bernadine Dorn said of the murders, "Dig it, first they killed the pigs, then they ate dinner in the same room with them, then they even shoved a fork into a victim's stomach. Wild." On February 17th, what appeared to be a copycat crime emerged, a hideous attack on a military family. A Green Beret captain, Jeffrey McDonald, reported regaining consciousness from a knife attack to find his wife and 2 children, Kristen and Kimberly, dead. He remembered what one of the intruders, a woman wearing a floppy hat and carrying a burning taper, chanted, "Acid is groovy. Kill the pigs." In St. Louis, at 2 a.m. on February 23rd, the Quonset hut housing Washington University's Army ROTC program was burned to the ground. In frigid Buffalo, on February 24th, the president of the State University of New York campus summoned cops to control the threatened disruption of a basketball game. The next night, 40 students stormed his office. A police squad chased them into the student union. 800 students attacked the police. At the precinct house, amid the Jewish-looking hall, one arrestee heard a cop say that America should have let Hitler win. He'd have known how to take care of these fuckers. That same day, William Kunstler, facing 2 years in jail for contempt of Judge Hoffman's court, gave a speech at the UC Santa Barbara Stadium. 10 years earlier, he had dropped out of the executive training program at R.H. Macy's. How things had changed. "I have never thought that the breaking of windows and sporadic, picayune violence is a good tactic," he now said. "But on the other hand, I cannot bring myself to become bitter and condemn young people who engage in it." Students whistled and cheered. Hundreds strolled to a rally in the adjacent town of Isla Vista. One of them idly swung around a bottle of wine. The cops, thinking it a Molotov cocktail, arrested him. Violence broke out. Kids burned down a Bank of America branch. Ronald Reagan ordered his attorney general to look into charging Kunstler with crossing state lines to incite a riot. On March 6th, a mysterious explosion collapsed an entire townhouse in Greenwich Village. Cops, searching through the rubble, pulled out 3 dead bodies and enough live-wire dynamite bombs to blow up the entire block if detonated at once. The house had been a bomb factory, and one of the bombs was intended to slaughter attendees at an upcoming dance at Fort Dix. One decapitated body was identified by a print taken from the severed little finger of the right hand. Diana Auten, a weatherman. Another was a leader of the 1968 Columbia University strike. The third was a weatherman based at Kent State University in Ohio. On March 11th, a bomb gashed a chunk out of the corner of the Dorchester County Courthouse in Maryland, site of pretrial hearings for H. Rapp Brown for inciting the burning of the schoolhouse in Cambridge in 1967. The next night, in Buffalo, hundreds of students fought a running battle with police, throwing Molotov cocktails at the faculty peace monitors trying to keep the two sides apart. 3 days later, Judge Hoffman received an enthusiastic clap on the shoulder from Richard Nixon. He was a special guest at the president's weekly Christian service in the East Room, where the Reverend Billy Graham preached that America's differences could melt in the heat of a religious revival. In New York City, one day in March, 15,000 people were evacuated from office buildings from 300 separate bomb threats. On April 4th, Governor Reagan, in a re-election campaign speech to the Council of California Growers, said of the government's dilemma of beating back the mounting violence, "If there is to be a bloodbath, let it be now." That America was in the middle of a civil war had once been but a metaphor. How soon before it became real?